It is true that some people who joined the army of Umar ibn Sa'd to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam were from Kufa. But at that time in the city of Kufa, Shia in today's understanding were not, so many. Let's explain that the word Shia in different periods of history has been used in different meanings and connotations.
Yes.
So it doesn't mean that in all the cases Shia is referred to Twelvers, those people who believe in 12 Imams. In some cases, the word Shia is used to refer to those people who just preferred Imam Ali alayhi salam over Uthman.
Yes.
But they believed in Abu Bakr and Umar as the first and the second caliphs. So for sure, they cannot be considered as the genuine Shia or the Twelver ones. Now, the history is telling us that when Muawiyah reached caliphate, he appointed Ziyad ibn Abi as the ruler of Kufa, and already Ziyad knew the true Shias, and he killed many of them, and many of them were arrested. So we can claim that in the city of Kufa, there were only very, very few people who were known as the Shia. By Shia now, I mean the Twelvers. Those who only accepted Imam Ali alayhi salam as the first and true successor of the Prophet.
Yes.
Although the number of the Kufans were, according to some historical reports, over 15,000 at the time of the tragedy of Karbala, only few of them were the Twelvers. The majority of the true Shia at that time were either martyred or arrested or exiled to other cities, or they themselves migrated to some other cities like Khorasan and Qom. This is one point. The second point is that some of the true Shias in the city of Kufa, when they wanted to join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they were prevented by the army of Ubaydullah bin Ziyad and his soldiers.
Yes.
In the city of Kufa. According to Ibn Abil Hadid, the great Mu'tazili scholar, Muawiyah sent a letter to one of his rulers that whoever tells you one of the virtues of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you may kill him. So my point is that at that very time, first of all, the genuine Shia were not, that many in the city of Kufa. And second of all, some of the true Shia who wanted to join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they were prevented and even some of them were arrested. For example, we have about Mukhtar al-Thaqafi that at the time of the tragedy of Karbala, he was in the prison. And when it comes to Tawabin, who were also among the genuine Shia of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they also did not join the army of Umar ibn Sa'd. At the same time, of course, they did not help Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and that is why they regretted a lot. And of course, some of them tried, but they were not able to do so.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir. Praises to Allah, all glories to Allah,
we worship Allah and no one but Allah. So my point is that in the city of Kufa, those people who wrote letters to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, at least the great majority of them are not the genuine Shia. They are the people who wanted Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to come and establish a government. And later, many of them, they were threatened by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. and they joined his army. So they didn't believe in Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam as the third Imam. They didn't invite Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam as the third Imam, as the third successor after the Holy Prophet. No, they just tried to establish a government led by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So we cannot consider them as genuine Shia.
That's right.
The next point is that when we analyze the history and we read the names of the main leaders of the army of Yazid, we see people like Umar bin Sa'd, Shamr ibn al-Jushan, Shabath bin al-Rib'i, Hajjar bin Abjar, Harmala Sinan, and we know that none of them is famous as Shia of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, as the genuine follower of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam.
For example, about Shem, they say that in Safin battle, he fought for Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Of course, yes, for him there are some historical reports for that, but it doesn't mean that he also believed in imamate of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam and imamate of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
People change.
No one considered him as a genuine Shia at the time of the tragedy of Karbala. And on the other hand, we see that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is calling these people Shia, but not Shia of Imam Ali alayhi salam, rather Shia of Abu Sufyan. We know that Shia literally means followers and supporters. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam addressing these people says, وَيْحَكُمْ يَا شِيعَةَ آلَ أَبِي سُفْيَانِ Woe be upon you, O the Shia, the followers of Abu Sufyan. إِلَّمْ يَكُنْ لَكُمْ دِينُكُمْ إن لم يكن لكم دين وكنتم لا تخافون المعاد فكونوا أحرارا في دنياكم هذه. If you do not believe in any religion, if you are not fearful of the resurrection day, at least be a free man in this world. The next point is that when we read what happened on the day of Ashura, on that very day, and those people who killed Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and attacked him and his companions and family members, let's see what are their statements, what they read in their poems as rajas, for example.
Yes.
For example, they said, إِنَّمَا نُقَاتِلُكَ بُغْضًا لِأَبِيكَ We are killing you, we are fighting you because we hate your father. Now the question is that, can we consider these people as Shia?
Mm-hmm.
A man who hates Imam Ali alayhi salam, can we consider him a Shia of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his father? This is mentioned in Yanabi' al-Mawadda by Qunduzi, page 346. Ibn Athir, a Sunni scholar, in his Al-Kamil, volume 4, page 67. One of them said, Ya Hussein, Ya Kadhab, Ibn al-Kadhab, na'udhu billah. Oh Hussein, the liar, son of liar. Mm-hmm. He's calling not only Imam Hussein alayhi salam as a liar, but also Imam Ali alayhi salam. Ya Hussein, Abshir bin Nar. Oh Hussein, I'm giving you the glad tidings of the hellfire. So even these phrases, these statements of the enemy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is telling us that they cannot be considered as the Shia. Now imagine that the enemy have killed Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions, and now they are attacking the family members to loot the properties. They set the tents into the fire. They behead the martyrs and so on and so forth. They take the family members as the captives. Can we consider them as Shia of Imam Ali alayhi salam? For sure, the answer is negative. As I mentioned, among those few Shia who are considered as genuine Shia in the city of Kufa, they were some who tried to join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and only few of them were able to flee from the soldiers of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad in Kufa, people like Zuhair and Habib ibn Muzahir. But there were other people, other Shia in the city of Kufa, genuine Shia, who also tried to join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but they were not able to do so, and for this some of them were even arrested and put in the prison.
Okay, that's right. And by the word Shia, we mean the faithful, we can say, and the ardent followers of the infallible Imams. This, as you said, this term has to be defined in the true way.
Mm-hmm.
The companions of the Imam who were martyred along with him, you know, are truly the Shias of infallible imams. And the Umayyads were taking revenge. You know, this has a historical background.
Definitely.
Of what happened, for example, to Abu Sufyan and their forefathers. And now this was the best time for them to take their revenge from Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yeah, just to share, a few remaining points. As I mentioned, some of the Shia were in the prison of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. According to some narrations, in the prison of Ubaydullah, there were about 12,000 people as mm-hmm. prisoners. And for sure, some of them were those genuine Shia who wanted to help Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but they were not able to do so, including Mukhtar and Sulaiman ibn Surat. And the next point is that some people of Kufa, some Shia, were forced to join the army of Ubaydullah to go and fight Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Otherwise, they could have been killed, so they were forced. But on their ways toward Karbala, many of them, they fled the army. For example, Baladari says that there was an army of 1,000 people going to Karbala by Ibn Ziyad. But when they reached Karbala, there were only 300 or 400, which means that there were some Shia in this army because they were forced, otherwise they could have been killed. But on their way, they fled the army and did not join the army of Umar ibn Sa'd. So the point is that, for sure, the genuine Shia did not join the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, and they have no role in killing Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karim. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Inna fil jannati nahran min labani. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
From Hollywood to hotel workers to Teamsters to manufacturing and elsewhere, there are so many labor actions in the United States, the mainstream media is calling it a hot labor summer. The problem isn't record heat, but low wages, poor working conditions, out-of-reach interest rates, and shocking levels of inequality amid the revocation of coronavirus-era social programs and unregulated profit hoarding by corporations. In Chicago, healthcare workers were striking for better wages and conditions amid record inflation and years of overwork.
Our members talk about all the time, does administration know how much the cost of a gallon of milk is, how much the cost of a dozen of eggs, you know, really is when you go to the store? It's just not adding up for them. They're having to pull double shifts, which is, you know, 12 to 16 hour shifts in order to be able to pay their bills.
In the largest mass layoff event since 2020, 30,000 workers and their households are now out of a paycheck after shipping giant Yellow declared bankruptcy on the eve of a labor strike. The administration of Joe Biden refused Yellow a bailout of around $1 billion, although he spent $23 billion to save two banks earlier this year and sends over $1 billion per week to fuel the unrest in Ukraine. Yellow employees registered their disgust.
We were going to go out on strike. We give them another 30 days to try to get their stuff together. And they forfeited. Of course, they're trying to sue the union, which is a joke. Shame on them. They got to lay their head down on the pillow at night, what they squandered all this money away.
Corporate bankruptcies have hit their highest first half levels since 2010. And many say forcing a recession to bring down inflation is the true goal of the federal interest rate hikes, despite the damage it's already having on the average worker's household and the economy.
We understand that it's not just hospital workers, but it's a wave throughout the country in regards to a small group of people having the power and making these decisions to really not benefit the majority, but the small minority of individuals that are not having the troubles our members are paying their bills.
Widespread strikes in the United States? That's something many Americans have never seen, and certainly their mainstream media isn't spending much time talking about the labor uprisings. But the post-corona landscape is being defined by economic difficulty and social unrest. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to four counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most presidential vote polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th, and if it is time to move on from the events that day. Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system. Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate. Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It has been 4 years since India removed the semi-autonomous status of the Indian administered portion of the Muslim-majority region of Jammu and Kashmir. But here, anger still rages. Hundreds of Pakistanis took to the streets across the country to mark this year's 5th August, the fourth anniversary of the New Delhi's decision to abolish the autonomy of the region by including it in the Indian Federation. In 2019, India scrapped the semi-autonomous status of the disputed region, a controversial move that prompted Islamabad to cut its diplomatic ties and halt trade with New Delhi. The protesters demanded the Indian government to end what they call illegal occupation of Kashmir, accusing it of grave human rights violations that are constantly being unearthed.
If the celebrated determination is granted to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the matter will be decided once for all. And if this matter is decided, the South Asia will be peaceful. There will be no nuclear war and there will be no conflict.
People also demanded the UN to implement a decades-old resolution that called for a referendum on whether Kashmiris wanted to merge with Pakistan or India.
We want to convey our message that we Kashmiri want our basic and fundamental right that was promised by United Nations and other organizations.
Besides rallies, conferences and seminars were also held in major cities and towns to denounce human rights violations in Jammu and Kashmir.
Whoever they are at the helm of affairs, that they should come forward and they should intervene. They should try to mitigate the human rights violations.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority Himalayan region, is divided between India and Pakistan, and both claim it in full. The Kashmir dispute also led to several wars between the two nuclear-armed Asian rivals since they were separated back in 1947.
Pakistanis keep saying that they will continue to lend moral, diplomatic and political support to the just cause of Kashmir. They have also called on neighboring India to honor its commitments to the Kashmiri people regarding the right to self-determination. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Leaving Lebanon's economy with an almost total economic meltdown, Riyad Salemi has stepped down as the governor of the central bank. The central bank's newly appointed acting governor, Wasim Mansouri, on Monday called on the government to implement a capital control law, a financial restructuring law, and a 2023 state budget within 6 months.
We were able to convince the government that the subsidies policy needs to stop, and as a result, management improved, and the economy relatively began to recover. However, the government's need for the U.S. dollar continues, since the only way to end the government's reliance on the central bank was to improve public finances. The problem is not monetary, and the solution is not with the central bank. The main issue is in the financial policies of the state, and there needs to be a clear decision to improve general management.
He stressed that the bank would impose restrictions on when to lend money to the government. Salemi was for years credited for economic recovery following Lebanon's civil war, yet now he is being investigated by at least 7 countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. He denies the accusations. A former advisor to 3 central bank governors in Lebanon tells Press TV that Salemi was merely following the U.S. policies.
He was implementing the U.S. policies, and U.S. policies since the end of World War II stipulated that the countries of the Third World are prohibited from development. They only allowed Korea and Taiwan to prosper since they want to confront China and Russia, but they also supported Israel in this region and even prevented Egypt from becoming an industrial nation.
The problem, he believes, is a problem of mismanagement as well as in the structure of the policies, which bound the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar.
He pegged the price of the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar, saying that this would stabilize the lira, but this was a catastrophic mistake, which I had warned against. The U.S. dollar itself is not stable, so pegging the lira to the U.S. dollar won't make it stable. We needed to peg our currency to a basket of currencies based on imports to Lebanon. This impacted Lebanon's ability to compete in the global markets.
The current financial crisis began in 2019 when the value of the Lebanese lira plummeted and inflation soared in the Arab country. After 30 years in his post, Lebanon's former central bank governor is seen by many experts as being the main orchestrator of the financial and monetary policies, which led to an abrupt collapse. However, there are also speculations that he couldn't have done it without collaboration from the country's political elite. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The
the Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Speaking to Press TV, Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defence of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. That turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to 5 deaths, a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6th, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections, in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in two other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress, the charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for a long, for all the crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president will have three criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
A private workshop in Kabul, where over 50 women are working and being trained, has provided a place for women to learn making different handicrafts. These women are producing stunning artifacts, despite the problems they stumble upon.
We produce traditional clothing such as leather purses and shoes, hats, carpets and traditional dresses. We used to earn a living previously, but now our sales have decreased and most families face economic problems as a result.
Fereshta Hashemi, the woman who launched this place, says more and more women are showing interest in private workshops because restrictions imposed by the Taliban has deprived them from social activities.
Previously, the schools and universities were open to women, but now, as a result of the restrictions on women, girls cannot go to school and female teachers have lost their job, which is why they show interest in learning a profession so they could work in the future and earn a living.
Lida, one of the trainees in this workshop, was a teacher when the Taliban banned women from education and women teachers lost their jobs. She says maybe in the future this profession helps her earn a living.
Previously, I was a teacher and I lost my job. I wanted to learn a profession, so I came here. I am learning leather crafting now and hope to run my workshop someday to earn a living.
When the Taliban took control of the country in 2021, they banned women from education and gradually from most of the jobs in the country. Even most female-dominated professions like women's hairdressing salons were closed a week ago. Women in Afghanistan are taking refuge in small businesses not only to provide for their families, but also to get relieved from the mental pressure of being restricted from education and the other jobs they used to do. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration plans to issue an executive order restricting investment in sensitive technologies in China this week. The news, which came shortly before the U.S. Commerce Secretary's reported China visit, is a flood pressure tactic repeatedly used by the U.S. regime, but it will fail again, as Chinese experts believe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, as the United States is intensifying technology blockade to contain China, which is getting increasingly ineffective, the reported investment restriction is against economic norms that will trigger a stronger backlash from American corporate investors and dent Biden's re-election chance, experts say. The executive order would restrict U.S. investment in China in high-tech sectors such as artificial intelligence, semiconductor chips, and quantum computing. Three people familiar with the matter told Nikkei Asia. The investment restrictions, which have been postponed on several occasions and could be delayed again, are not expected to take effect right away, according to Reuters. The news comes as Bloomberg reported that U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo is planning to visit China in late August. According to Reuters, the topic also came up last month during U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's meeting with Chinese officials. The recent series of visits by senior U.S. officials to China is not simply a case of Washington's efforts to ease bilateral tensions, as some Western media reports claim. Zhao Lingyun, an expert at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences in Beijing, told the Global Times recently. Zhao said the news intentionally leaked in order to put pressure on China on the eve of meetings between Chinese and U.S. officials in a frequently used U.S. political tactic to win a prior advantage. But the petty move won't force China to comply with arbitrary demands. Experts say issuing a clumsy administrative order that goes against economic principles is another flawed move aimed at decoupling and breaking industrial supply chains and weaponizing economic and trade issues. Zhao says the plan to restrict investment in the technology sector obviously creates great uncertainty and risks for U.S. corporate investors. If U.S. President Joe Biden chooses to harm the interests of U.S. companies in such a clumsy way using executive orders, his re-election prospects will suffer. In response to questions about the reported plan, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said earlier that China opposes the U.S. politicizing and weaponizing trade and technology issues. It is in no one's interest to place arbitrary curbs on normal technology cooperation and trade, violate the principles of the market economy, and destabilize global industrial and supply chains. If the U.S. government keeps on suppressing and blocking China's technological development, the U.S. will hurt both itself and others, and damage international trade and the global economy. U.S. politicians are weaponizing economic and technological cooperation in an attempt to maintain its absolute technology hegemony. This will stir up a stronger backlash from the business community, both in the U.S. and abroad. According to Reuters, President Joe Biden is expected to issue his long-awaited executive order to screen outbound investment in sensitive technologies to China, according to people familiar with the matter. A White House spokesperson declined to comment. The goal of the order is to prevent U.S. capital and expertise from accelerating the development of technologies that would support China's military modernization and threaten U.S. national security, as it claims. The order is expected to target U.S. private equity, venture capital, and joint venture investments in China in semiconductors, quantum computing, and artificial intelligence. Most investments captured by the order will require that the government be notified about them. Some transactions will be prohibited, sources have said. Coral Hall, a former U.S. Commerce Department official, said, "It fills a gap in our current regime. We have prohibitions on exporting the technology. We have restrictions on inbound investment. This will help to plug that gap on funding and know-how and give the government visibility into these capital flows." According to Reuters, the regulations are not expected to take effect right away, and the administration will solicit comment on its proposals. It has already conducted meetings with stakeholders and has been consulting with allies. The topic also came up last month during U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's meeting with Chinese officials. In a briefing with reporters at the end of her trip, Yellen said the potential restrictions were highly targeted and clearly directed, narrowly, at a few sectors where they have a specific national security concerns, she claimed.
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Youth Station here on IRIB English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio, I am honored to be joined by my brother in faith and humanity.
Thank you, Brother Habib, at your service.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, bro.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. First and foremost, may Allah reward you.
Great in your reward.
Yes. And I think being able to cry for Abu Abdullah alayhi salam is in and of itself a reward.
It is actually.
Isn't it?
It is.
To have the love. Isn't there a hadith that says when Allah wishes well for one of his servants, he places the love of Hussein alayhi salam in his heart.
And visiting Imam Hussein as well.
Exactly. So just to be able to love him enough to cry for him is a reward itself. What else do you want from life? Basically, Muslims and mostly Shias and even a lot of people from other faiths and denominations, you know, if they don't mourn, at least they commemorate Ashura and the events that took place in Karbala and the tragedy of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
The rest of the Imam alayhi salam, do you see them as role models?
They are. I hope I'm following.
What's the difference between Imam Sadiq alayhi salam or Imam Kadhim or Imam Ridha alayhi salam, who accepted, of course, you know, after the pressure, accepted being wali al-ahd, accepted allegiance? Or what's the difference with Imam Hassan alayhi salam, who just agreed
To the peace treaty.
To the peace treaty. Imam Hussein alayhi salam as well. Imam Hassan fought at the beginning.
Obviously.
He went through war. Right? He had people underneath him. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in your state of mind, in your beliefs, in your eyes, as well, had people, but then they left.
people me, knew, there's no difference people between knew that what Abbasid Imam al-Hassan caliphates. Did and what Imam al-Hussein did.
One pledged allegiance with Muawiyah, the other didn't.
It was just a means. The objective was the same. The objective, the goal, the main priority were all the same.
To protect the Shia's blood?
To please God.
To please God?
To carry out their mission. And that's the how they did it. Based
so each
on their
imam,
circumstances.
Each imam had their own circumstance. Each imam had their own role. You could learn from each role. You could take from each role. What I want to say here is that I hate this idea that of people trying to belittle the sorrowness or crying towards about Imam Hussein.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Let's work on that. Let's work on that. You say that the greatest part, if not only, profound aspect of Abu Abdullah's movement was to stir.
I'm not saying to stir. I'm not saying that it's to stir. I'm saying that the A'imma alayhum as-salam, our school of thought, whenever we see, when it comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they're always ordering us. They're always telling us to cry. They're always telling us to...
It's just a means of commemoration. It's our way of celebrating and remembering him.
Imam Hussein, there is no such thing as, for example, always remember al-amr al-ma'ruf and nahy al-munkar that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did in the sayings. I'm asking you, who, for example, wants to take this new idea, wants to take something else other than crying. What do you want from the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam? If you say, for example, being a good person, let's say, right? Having good characteristics, being a good believer. The rest of the imam alayhi salam also have this
character. Are you saying that crying for him alone, just crying
the
for
story
Imam,
of Imam Hussein
is enough? I don't need to adhere to any other principle that Imam fought for, just as long as I cry for him.
That's the thing. What did he fight for?
That's what I'm saying.
What did he fight for?
That's what I'm saying.
Did he fight defending?
He fought for the same principles Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam signed a peace treaty for, okay? The principles and the objectives are the same. The methods and circumstances were different, right? And at the end of the day, I cry for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to reinforce my adherence to those common principles. You know what I'm saying? And that's what makes Imam al-Hussein's movement the most profound, because no other a'imma managed to stir and provoke emotions on the same level as Abu Abdullah. They all talked about Amr bil Ma'ruf. They all talked about justice. They all talked about piety. They all talked about submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But Imam al-Hussein did it through blood. And that's what makes him awesome.
The thing what I want to say...
No, tell me you disagree with me.
I disagree.
Okay, fine.
I disagree. The thing that what I want to state is that there's something, sometimes we talk about the imma altogether, their movement altogether, their duty as the imma alayhum salam. Then there's also the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam by itself. Which two are you talking about?
They're all the same.
There's something special about the story of Imam Hussein.
There's a oneness in it all.
There's something in the story of Imam Hussein that differs from the rest. That makes it special. And it's that it clings the Shia, the followers towards Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Because of the level of emotions he provokes.
It has the power to make people attached to the story. Right?
That's why he's the Safina Najat.
Usually how do we do it?
By crying.
That's it. That's what I want to say.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You're getting closer to the Imam alayhi salam.
Bro, as always... For the listeners who've been listening to us throughout the years, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm saying. As always, once again, we've come to the exact same conclusion.
I want to ask you, what did you learn from the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam? How do you put it in your daily life?
So there's two things to it, right? If we're going to talk about it on a personal level.
Yes.
Number one, because of the reasons that you stated, because of the emotional bond Imam al-Hussein managed to create between himself and all of humanity, I have developed a very strong, very special love for him. And that has led me to want to align all of my actions naturally with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and get his approval in every aspect of my life.
Okay.
Right? So maybe Imam Hussein alayhi salam didn't specifically talk about a certain matter on Ashura, though I believe Ashura is so comprehensive and it's so inclusive that it basically covers every aspect of a human being's life. It's like the Quran unfolded into half a day. But even if Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam didn't talk about a specific matter on the day of Ashura, because I love him so much, I want to get close to him in everything. That's what I learned from Imam al-Hussein. I learned love from him. I learned how to live from him.
So pretty much he became your role model, to go to person to take, you know, your daily lifestyles from.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no matter what I'm going to do, I'd be like, is this going to get me closer to him or not? Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا حسين يا صار الله لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا حسين يا صار الله
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab and my co-host,
Brother Habib, at your service. You being sad and sorrow for his, you know, tragedies, then having a connection with him. Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
Take that away. What else? I was asking a different, other than this, what do you have?
No, that's it.
That's
no,
it.
No, it's because I love him so much. Mm-hmm.
How did this love come?
From
not because he wanted to go to a war or wanted to do a revolt or anything. Just, you know, because it's tragedy.
Probably, yes. But then also, you know, it's a yes and no. Imam al-Hussein could have not affected people on the scale had he not been tragically killed the way he was, right?
Okay.
That's an obvious fact. No one's going to dispute with it.
All right.
Right? But then again, people do establish such a bond with other Aimma as well. Like my Baba. He's crazy about Amir al-Mu'mineen. Everything about his life is like Amir al-Mu'mineen this, Amir al-Mu'mineen. He's memorized all of the sermons of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He knows the Nahj al-Balagha by heart. Amir al-Mu'mineen wasn't slaughtered in cold blood the way Abu Abdullah was with his companions. He was martyred, but it wasn't as brutal as Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. You know, I'm saying that yes and no. Imam al-Hussein managed to have such a profound impact on humanity because of the manner of his uprising and death. But on the other hand, if that factor did not exist, Imam al-Hussein would still be Imam al-Hussein. The same way Imam al-Hassan is still Imam al-Hassan. Because kulluhum nur al-wahid. They're the same light, the same people, the same objectives, the same goals.
Exactly.
Just different circumstances and means.
Okay.
All right.
All right. But you didn't answer me the question.
Wait.
And that is, if you take away the crying part, you take away the sorrow, you take away, let's say that Imam Hussein alayhi salam didn't go to Karbala. Karbala didn't happen. Right? What do you learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam?
He died some other way?
Let's say he died a normal death.
He can't. He's an imam.
I'm saying imagine it.
No, but he can't. You know, it's like if he didn't die in Karbala, he would have been martyred some other
all
way.
Right.
Then how is that
he
different?
He was poisoned like Imam Kadhim, alayhi salam. All right? But not in prison.
Well, I probably would have learned something from his... See, there's this thing, right? The Aimma alayhi salam, they all share common principles. Right? And everything they did was toward the same unanimous direction. Pleasing Allah, carrying out their mission, and creating awareness among people. Establishing justice to the best of their capacity.
Imam Askari wasn't able to make that much awareness through people.
But he did create awareness for those he had to in regard with his son, which was his greatest mission.
All right.
Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Like, I don't want this to turn into a theology, aqaid lesson for our listeners. But I'm saying that, yes, Imam al-Hussein did what he did, was able to do what he has done to humanity because of those very peculiar circumstances. But if those peculiar circumstances had not taken place, he would have still done something awesome, just like every other imam did.
All right.
What do I learn from Imam al-Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam? Total submission.
So,
In conclusion.
I reached to my point. There is nothing else behind the story of Imam Hussein in Karbala other than sorrow and grief. If you want to take away the sorrow and grief, you'd have to take away the entire movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Taking away the entire movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you have to start a new story. So at the end of the day, crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam
is profound. It's definitely very profound.
It's the fundamental, it's the base.
But crying because, not for the sake of crying alone. It's not crying because we cry. It's crying because of the injustice that was committed against him.
Because when I cry, I'm crying, yeah, like how you stated, rahmatan lahum. I'm crying because of what affected them. I'm crying what the pains that they went through. Their
because
pain is my
them.
Pain. Exactly.
Because you love them.
Exactly. And not only that, but I'm doing something even more. Is'ad Fatima alayhi salam, wasli Rasulillah. Is'ad, of course, is not the translation of happiness. Is'ad is something else.
What does it mean?
Arabs, the mother, usually when her sons die or someone, a family member dies, her tears dry off because she cried so much.
Right.
So she needs some other people to come over
and cry with her
and to help her. As'ada, meaning to help her. So you come and say, I've seen Arabic women do it, Iraqi women actually do it. She's sitting on the grave. She can't cry. There are no tears. The woman comes. He was handsome. He had two children. She brings up the tributes.
Why?
He was brave. And then she would start crying again.
Trust me. That's torture.
I have a family story. It's not torture. It brings bond together.
Okay.
It brings bond. Because she wants to cry, but she's not able to cry.
There's a great mystery and unimaginable merit in crying for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. Otherwise, history would have taken a different course altogether. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Thank you for being with me and Brother Habib. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.